Bam, and we're live from Radio Espacio. What's up, everybody? I don't know if you can tell, but I'm sick. Or at least I have been sick. Not that I'm contagious anymore.
Thank you.
But I was sick like the first week of the year. And I'm like, I'm still getting over it. But here we are, episode 4, Orale Bo Heights. Today, another special duper, super duper awesome guest. And I'm kind of excited because we've known each other for a while online and personally for like a good chunk of time now. And you're one of those folks that I know where like I can always like geek out with like very specific things like wrestling and anime, but then also talk shop about like journalism and like what's going on. So the one and only Javier Cabral, say hi.
What's up, everyone? How's everyone doing out there? In this?
That's Eric, everyone. That's Eric. Please stand by. It's technical difficulties.
Stand by. So what just ended up happening with all that noise was I was moving the microphone and it completely just like buckled under me. And this has happened before too, but usually like, see, look, it only has like this big like bag clip on it. So it's not really like sturdy. Yeah. It happened to me once.
Everyone's okay. Boyle Heights is still okay.
We survived. But yeah, usually I'm just like, I just show up. I do things.
You know, that you can always just hold a mic like Danzig, like this,
like upside down.
No, like this. Like if you're like fisting it, you look extra cool.
Yeah. I think we might be talking for a while, so my arm's gonna get tired. But I think I might end up having to do that because this little swivel, like I don't know, like I did this once already, like where it did this to me once, where like it doesn't, it's like a praying mantis arm, but it doesn't want to like stick. And I don't want to be holding it because like yours is working. I was setting up earlier.
Yeah, we can just share one, like dual cell.
Champless. Let me get one of those mic stands. Hold on. Do this the easier way. Bag clip.
There we go.
You know.
That's Mexican ingenuity at its finest right there, dude.
Puro Mickey Mouse. Oh, but now it's like a little top heavy. All right, I guess I'll just have to hold it.
Or you can just put,
like, loosen it up a little bit. There you go, like that.
All right.
All right.
Are people still listening?
People should be listening.
Like, screw these guys. Just like fucking. I'm sorry. Can I cuss or no?
You can say whatever the hell you want, man.
All right, cool.
This is the internet.
I'm used to KPFK Ultra Power. Like where if you say a cuss word, like everyone's, oh crap, check button.
Yeah, beep 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 beep. No. I think folks know, but at this point, I pretty much say anything and everything that comes to my mind. Sometimes that I shouldn't be saying. But that's how it goes. All right, cool. So how's your day going, man?
Good. You know what? Just got back from a honeymoon, and I was out in Europe. And
yeah, congratulations,
thank you, man. I really, it was awesome. You know, baguettes are awesome. Shout out to baguettes, but I really miss tortillas. and craft beer. You know, wine and baguettes is awesome, but it's definitely good to be back home. Got back from. I was gone for, wait, what were you gonna ask?
Yeah, how long were y'all over?
Dude, we were gone for a year. I mean, I'm sorry, for a month.
All right, for that a month. Like a year. That's a long
Yeah, for
time.
A month, for a month. So, yeah, man, but definitely good to be back home.
Damn, but that must have been, was that your first time in Europe?
Yeah, that was my first time in Europe, and it was such a trip to see, like, the, you know, as a Mexican-American, like, in Spain for the first time, it was a trip to see, like, the origins of a lot of, like, dishes that you think are Mexican, but they're actually not. Like, everything from mazapanes, you're like, no, not mazapanes, too. Everything, you know, just cheese
it's
culture.
Trip, like, going down that, like, the heritage route and, like, the trees of, like, where things started with, like, pan, with the French and, like, polka music.
Yeah.
And, like, accordions in Mexico and beer and all this other stuff, and it's, like, a mishmash of so many things.
Yeah, I know, and, like, you know, I'm not gonna lie, you know, my first thought as soon as the airplane landed in Spain, it was like,
I'm tired.
I was like, these guys conquered us.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the truth. Like, you know, I mean, I'm like, I want to go to Europe. I want to go to England, Spain, all these places. But at the same time, when you think about it, like, and you step back, you're like, yeah, these are like the colonizers of the world. And that's part of the reason why I want to go visit those places is because these are really old, like towns, cities, neighborhoods, countries. you know, compared to the United States, it's only been around a couple of hundred years, and this place has been around like 1,000 years.
Yeah, for sure.
The architecture was, is so much different.
Exactly. It was beautiful. It was awesome. And, you know, we would do experiments. We would, for one day, we would just say we were from U.S. or from, I mean, actually, we would say we were from Los Angeles. And then and another day, we would just speak Spanish all day and just say we were from Mexico, because my wife is from Mexico.
Yeah.
And then, like, if you say you were from Mexico, it was, like, a night and day difference from, like, if you were from U.S. Like, oh, I'm Mexique. I love Mexico. It's so beautiful. And it's so,
like, the food is... Almost any other part of the world you go to,
But, like, L.A. or U.S., it's, like, as soon as they don't hear you speaking the language or speaking the language with the accent, then it's like, they treat you pretty rudely.
But, I've heard a lot of that, because the reputation does not have a great... The U.S. doesn't have a great reputation around the world, so it doesn't surprise me that it'll be like kind of like the way it is here in where we live. If, like, you see somebody that I don't recognize that I think is not from the neighborhood, you get the like the stink eye.
Yeah.
But damn, that's awesome. And then part of like when y'all were like getting ready to go out there, you retold like how you met your wife in the New York Times.
Yeah, you know what? when I proposed to her and we got married, like, I mean, when we got engaged. One of the first things she told me, she's like, what I want you to do, and like, I want to be on the New York Times on the wedding, because they have like a special wedding section on Sundays.
Oh.
So it's like the vow section, and like, but usually everyone that's on there is like pretty privileged and pretty white and pretty
New York elite.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like all of them are like the majority of them are like that. So Paul was like, all right, well I want to be like the first like Mexican, or like I want to have like some, you know, some Mexican representation on there. And sure enough, you know, I pitched my ass off, spent like a week making sure it was the best pitch ever.
Yeah.
Sent it off, and yeah, they responded and they wrote it. So it was pretty crazy, man.
So let folks know a little bit. I mean, if they can't like take 5 seconds to Google it, like what did you write?
So it was All right. So in 2011, I was probably what, like 20 years old. I wrote my first cover story for Sever Magazine, which is like this kind of hardcore food magazine in New York. And it was about
like punk rock hardcore.
No, like just like food, like food, like gourmet food, you know, just like food culture. And I don't know how this happened. It's a long story, but I ended up somehow writing a cover story for them that was about my mom, about Zacatecas, about the food of Zacatecas. Because if you think about it, Zacatecas, or it's not one of the glamorous states in Mexico like that that you read about like constantly, especially like food writers. You know, food writers they romanticize the canon, which is Mexico City, Oaxaca, and Puebla. Maybe
Sinaloa for like
Sinaloa for seafood. But like, you know, but there's so many other states, and every other state has their own distinct.
That's like the meat and bread of like everybody selling food.
Exactly.
Out here.
So I wrote that story, and it ended up being a cover story that was like a pretty big deal. And then my wife now she was going to school in Portland, because she is from Puerto Vallarta, but she transferred there for school. And she subscribed to this magazine, and it was the first magazine. It was the first issue that came to her house. So then, like, she read it, and she was like, at first, she was like a hater, you know, like any other Mexican, like, he's like, who's this guy? He's probably some guy who went to Mexico for a week and thinks he's like an expert now, and
sure enough,
and then she Googles me. I'm like, oh, it's this guy with like long hair and into punk music. Because then one thing led to another, and 6 years later, we're here.
She slid into the DM.
Exactly, she slid into the DM.
It's funny because I was just talking to my girl about that. We were having dinner at Un Solo Sol before coming over here. And we were just talking about that because she really follows you online. She's been following your stuff.
Honored.
For a good couple of years before even we met, probably. Her name is Marisol.
Oh, okay.
Shout out, Marisol.
Shout out to the girls in our lives. Without you, we're nothing.
No, we're not. But we were talking about that because, you know, she brought up that New York Times piece. And I was like, yeah, like, that's very similar to us. Because we've met each other for a long time in, like, the social justice spaces. And we knew each other. But it wasn't until, like, 3 years ago where I was on another friend's podcast. And she listened to it. And she slid into the DMs, like, you know, talking to me about, like, yo, I heard your podcast. That was really funny. You know, I'm going through the same thing. Because at that point, anytime I got a chance to talk about it, I always talk about, like, my gripes with dating, you know, in person, and, like, doing it on the internet, and, like, using...
No, I read some of your stuff, man. I know. You unload.
It's the curse of the Mexican chaparro. So, I mean, she dug the podcast. So we started talking, and she DM'd me on Twitter, and then we took it to like text messaging. Then we started talking to the phone. And between her like sending me a Twitter message and us meeting, that was a full month. And it started on her birthday, which is on June 23rd, and then we met in person on my birthday on July 22nd, 3 years
ago. Damn.
And now 3 years later, she lives here.
Wow.
Yeah.
So. Shout out to Twitter for making both of our lives fucking awesome. And sorry, ladies, but both Eric and I are off the market.
We're taken. That's hilarious. But yeah, dude, I mean, I'm excited to have you here because you're one of those folks. You're out there, but at the same time, you're also low-key because, you know, you're always like, I think you're always just grinding all the time from one project to the next. And you've done a lot of stuff, but I think right now you're just at the point where, like, you're trying to work on your own brand, because I know you brought back your personal website, and you're still doing freelance, though.
Yeah, man. You know, I basically hit my dream job of, like, you know, working for Vice and being a reporter for them and a staff writer.
Yeah, you were doing munchies.
I was doing munchies, and it was awesome. You know, I got to use the word shit in my food writing every once in a while and write about weed. And
now everybody's using shit.
I know
in
now.
Writing.
But, you know, it came to the point where you just kind of realized that, like, you know, you just gotta look out for yourself, you know, and only for yourself. So, and plus it's a bunch of people from New York. So I try my best to East Coast,
Bushwick, hipsters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was a very different demographic, but you know what? My proudest accomplishment for them was having the first bilingual, Spanglish headline on them, you know, like
you were holding it down,
you're using the word abuela in there in the headlines. And just having more representation. So it was awesome, and I learned a lot. But yeah, now I'm back to just focusing on myself. And right now, the current project is I'm co-writing a cookbook. So that's going to be really exciting.
What?
A cookbook. So
you get down, you're in the kitchen.
I'm co-writing it with, I haven't told anyone yet, but I guess you're breaking it for Galaguetza.
Oh, dope. Yeah. I love that restaurant.
Yeah.
And they got the Michelada Mobile.
Exactly, dude. Yeah, that's I've drank probably like a stupid amount of those things. So. Oh,
man, they're so good. I mean, I have to cut back sometimes because I used to buy the Michelada mix from like Ramirez, and I was like, this is too much. Like, turn it down a notch. But that's dope, man. And then you just wrote something for the LA Times, too.
Yeah, today. I wrote that thing like so long ago, And then today it came out. It was a story. You know, I grew up along Whittier Boulevard. At first, it was in front of Salazar Park.
La Whittier.
Exactly, in front of La Whittier. And it was in front of Salazar Park. And then after that, for my second half of my life, when I went to Garfield, it was off of like literally like a block away from the Whittier Arch on McBride.
What?
So my whole life has been on Whittier. And like a lot of my best friends have been sons and daughters from people from Puebla. And you know, I realized, like some of my earliest memories are my older brother telling me like, hey, can you go buy me a semita with extra chipotle from the semita truck? And this was back in like late 90s, dude, like before Y2, wait, who's the wrestler? Y2J.
Y2J
is the wrestler. Okay. Y2K
was the 2000 yeah. millennial shitstorm.
Yeah. So semitas and comida poblana have been around me my whole life.
Yeah, it's a staple. If you're like around from the hood, you eat like that's one of like your food groups.
Almost. Yeah, yeah. Especially in East LA. In East LA, it's more it's people from Puebla. In Koreatown, it's like Oaxaca, right? So yep. if you have mole in East LA, if you have like mole at a restaurant, it's most likely going to be mole poblano.
Mm-hmm.
And like in Koreatown, it's going to be like mole oaxaqueño.
So
I realized, and then you know, my whole life I've survived off those all those trucks, the semita trucks with the neon flashing neon signs, and when you're driving by or walking by, sometimes it's almost like Vegas on some nights, you know, because you have like the smell of churros on the by Lorena, and then like so I was like, man, this is like low key like some like this just has enough restaurants and food, and then I straight up Googled it, and it's like I think there are, I don't know how, I think over like 30 something restaurants in East LA that just have like comida de Puebla.
Yeah,
and like this could be like its own name, like little, you know, like people like to call like little Armenia or little like or Filipino town or Tokyo. It's like this could be like little Puebla, so that's why I dubbed it on like Puebla. I called it a poblano roll
because
there's so much comida from Puebla.
There is.
So today the article is about that. It's just I found a place in Commerce that has mole de olla, which it's an amazing. It's like a caldo de res, but spiced with mole.
Damn.
So it's so damn bomb, and it hits a spot in this weather. So check that out today. And if anyone's reading this, pick up a copy tomorrow and support print journalism. For both Eric and I.
Let them know. Like, I bought this just because Javier told me to.
Yeah, so, and go eat some semitas.
And eat some semitas. I love it. I mean, the one thing I don't like is I forgot the name of the leaf.
Papalo?
The papalo leaf.
Come on, dude. You got to enter your inner indigenous and just, like...
When I was
just
younger...
Just chew on it and then have those burps after, you know?
I would, like, you know, open it up and take it out and put, like, extra chile. But now that I'm older, like, my palate's changing in a lot of different ways. Like, I do get down with
it. I'm not going to lie. That is a strong answer. The first time I wrote about it, I think I said that it tastes like a herb, like a shrub, like a herb that where a deer pissed on it. It's just so damn it's ammonia.
Yeah.
It's not even bitter, it's like ammonia. It's like you're like you have that and you're like, how does this fit? But you know, like,
taste the chipotle, the queso, the meat,
but you
bread.
Know nowadays you can just get that without it and it's still as bomb. So
of course so cool. So let's get into some of that, what you kind of already got into. Like, you grew up in East LA, you went to Garfield, I went to Roosevelt,
I was supposed to go to Roosevelt, but then got transferred to Garfield instead. But I went to Hollenbeck, so I could claim Boyle Heights.
There you What's up? It's close enough, man. But yeah, I mean, like, how was it growing up with you? Like, you were already saying, you know, part of that experience growing up on Whittier, especially with your family, was like, yo, let's go get something to eat down the street. Like what are there some other things you remember from living down there?
You know what? To be honest, like I was kind of like, you know, like the typical, you know, rebel kid that, you know, you grew up eating Mexican food, right? You grew up having tacos. You grew up having like guisados. You grew up having like huevos.
That's the norm, yeah.
So then, like, when I would go eat out, I would search for something else. Like, I wanted to go experience, like what else can, like, I buy that, like, something that I can't get at home. And like my dad also would always tell me the same thing. He's like, you know, para comida mexicana en la casa, like, let's go have something else. So we ended up always going to the San Gabriel Valley, dude. You know, it's like tapping into that.
Going
a little northeast and from East LA and just ordering pho. You know, like my dad got down with, I mean, he called it like sopa china, you know, which even though it's not Chinese, but it's Vietnamese,
course,
but you know, pho and like dim sum too. So I would get down with the San Gabriel spots because I'm originally from, I mean, I was up until like second grade, I used to live in Alhambra. Then from there, I moved to East LA. And then from East LA, bounced around to Boyle Heights and then back to East LA.
Yeah,
So San Gabriel Valley is also, so we would always go to like Golden Deli, you know, which is a badass, a fuss spot, you know, just super awesome. And then, and still to this day, like, I think about it, and it's like, you know, there's like that question of like, what would be like your death row meal or like your last meal? I'm like, I love nopales con tortillas y chile, but I also get down with pho. You know, it's like it would be up there. So
I mean, that's when I get sick. That's my, or even when I start thinking I'm gonna get sick, let's go get some pho.
Yeah. Boom. Yeah.
Like, maybe switch it up later in the week or something with like caldo de res, caldo de pollo.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I mean, like once I was full blown sick, I was trying to eat pho like every other day.
Yeah, and it's you know, I'm more in the mindset of like it's a little on the healthier side just because of the collagen and it's just really comforting, you know.
To me, it's just really good food that's really comforting, and it might not be the healthiest, maybe because of the way that I order it or where I'm getting it from, but it's just one of those foods that makes you feel really good, like no matter.
But growing up, to like some of my earliest memories, it's actually like fast food, dude. I ate a lot of fast food growing up, you know, because you know both my parents we had a lot of financial hardships and you know.
I mean, like,
so you know what's
like,
up, you know,
somebody said it once, I forgot who, I think it was like Steve Harvey or a comedian, they're like, we were so poor every day, but back then we had Happy Meals every day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's what, dude, it got to the point where like I knew like I would do, I call it like the happy, like the kid meal circuit, you know. You would, one day it was like Wiener Schnitzel, the other day was like Burger King plain cheeseburger, don't give me nothing crazy on my cheeseburger. And then, like, you know, or Popeyes or like, Popeyes. Or the personal pizza because of Book It and Pizza Hut, you know, or In-N-Out if you really get like a certificate. So, you know, you got a lot of help from the school too, to eat shitty food for free. So.
Man. I remember at one point when I was in school, they started introducing where you can give your lunch ticket and you can get a slice of Domino's.
Oh man, dude. Yeah, I remember that. I remember that. I mean, but I don't know. For me, I mean, this is going way into the rabbit hole. But like, I think that was like some like B grade shit, dude. Because the pizza did not taste like when you order like a pizza, like Pizza Loca or Domino's. It tasted like a little weirder at school. I don't know.
Like, I never really like. I mean, there was some school foods that I like, just because I mean, I spent a good chunk of my childhood eating that food, and I'm like. Like you're like, I have this little lunch ticket lapel that people have been tripping out lately, and I'm like, yeah, Because that was county food, like those cheeseburgers that came in the little plastic
bag. Yeah.
Chalupas. Oh, man. Pizza Day. Brunch. Nutrition was the jam, though, because you get your...
Like your cookies and
the
yogurt, dude.
Your yogurt, your...
your plate.
Very berry juice, your burrito, dude, with hot, like, sauce.
So much sugar, dude. It's insane if you think about it now. But I remember I would, like, my little food ways as a little kid, I would bring my own, like, salt packets.
Really?
For my potato wedges at school, because they were so bland and so, like, nasty. Dude. So I would just, like, bring pepper and salt.
Just put ketchup on them.
Shout out to LAUSD for making us into strong men.
Man, like I kind of look back at that, and it's like I kind of miss it, but at the same time I don't, because there were times where, like, I wouldn't eat anything. And it would just be like a can of soda and a bag of chips.
Yeah, dude.
But then, sometimes, like,
breakfast deluxe of Mexican American champs right there.
You're like, you're eating the hot Cheetos, but then you take it up a notch and put, like, nacho cheese,
dude. I know. Oh, man. I don't even.
And then, that's the thing, too, because in junior high, we had to wear a uniform. So when I got, like, nacho anything, it was like, right on my shirt.
Yeah, and then even that, you can't eat, like, nacho cheese Flaming Hots with your hands. It's like, you have to eat them with a fork. Like, there's no way. And then, like, you're going to stab through the plastic bag and then it's going to leak on you.
Yeah. I had friends who would put the pickle juice in it. That's too hardcore.
Pickle juice, nacho cheese, and lime. Because, you know, people still put lime on everything. So,
of course. Yeah, that's why they made hot Cheetos with limon.
You know who makes a really good version nowadays? It's still what it is. What it is. It's like nacho cheese with Flaming Hots. But there's a bar with food in Huntington Park called Novocaine.
You're the second person to tell me about Novocaine.
Dude, I love Novocaine. Novocaine is, like, such a badass little spot. And also, I love that.
Is it fairly new?
It's, I would say, probably like 2 years, maybe.
Okay. Because I looked it up on Google Maps and it's, I saw, like, where it's at. It's this is kind of like.
It's essentially the only spot in your OGHP where you can just get some good craft beer or they have, like, a really good, just simple bar menu, you know. But they on the menu, that, like, they actually, you're, like, looking at the menu, it's like Flaming Hots with nacho cheese. Like, ooh. Cool, it's made it to this level now. Like, you can order at a bar, and it's like, in hindsight, that is the perfect drinking food. It's probably not the best breakfast food growing up with a Coke, but it is, like, the best drinking food.
Bar food in terms of, like, wings, nachos, things with cheese. Sure.
You eat before dinner, like, you know, but you don't have a full meal out of just that, you know. So.
The last time I went to Huntington Park was I took my girl. Well, recently, because we were just on our way from something, we went to In-N-Out. But the last time I went there properly, I went to Underground Arcades on Saturday.
What? And you should go. Let me know next time.
I don't know. I've been trying to go back, but every time I go, it kind of, like, I think it's still there, but they kind of, like, die down in quality each time I go. Because, like, they don't, you know, they don't really maintain the machines. You know, it's just, like, one big sweat pit in there.
Yeah.
So, like, and most of the time I end up, like, just playing ping pong or, like, pool or something like that.
That's where I normally go to a Neon Retro Arcade in Pasadena.
That's right.
I go there pretty often, like, probably once a week or once every 2 weeks. But it's more of a different concept. You just pay $10 per hour, but all the machines are set to free play.
And so
there's no chance of
being. No, because I mean, I go to the arcades like 82 and the artists are like, all right, $5. And then I'm drinking and I don't know how much I'm spending. So I'm like, $5 deep into the Simpsons game.
Exactly. No, they're, and it's awesome. And also because the owners really pride themselves in the cabinets. So, like, so it has, like, the original art for the Simpsons or the original art for the buttons are all, like, the original colors. So it's more of a retro experience. So it's a bit of an experience, but it's awesome, dude.
I miss that. I mean, I was reminiscing about it the other day when I went to go get birria because I saw the machines at La Lavanderia. And I'm like, that was life. For me, that was life.
Yeah,
I used
me too.
Ditch middle school PE just to go play video games and play Mortal Kombat.
Dude, yeah. I mean, I grew up next to the pet source on Whittier Boulevard, like the pet shop. It's in front of Salazar Park. And next to that was a laundromat. And every other day I would go play, like, you know, some King of Fighters or Marvel's Capcom, you know, when it first came out.
Metal Slug.
What was the soccer one?
Forgot, but everybody was like always playing. They were playing the one that was, like, more, like, pixelated, and then the one that's kind of, like, looked like Virtual Fighter.
Yeah,
and the people were getting, like, hardcore down on it. Like, that was the two games because there was that little corner store outside across the street from Roosevelt. So in my senior year, like, after school, I would go there and we would be playing Tekken or that soccer game.
Mm.
I was like, I kind of miss that. I mean, I have a PlayStation now, and I'm. Like, I play, like, the older games, like the Metal Slug games on it, but it's not the same.
Dude, you would love Neon, dude. Let me know next time we'll go.
I was trying to go the other day, and I was like, they closed early. What? I thought this place was a bar.
No bar. But you can do just go to a Stone Tap Room, because it's, like, a block away.
It's the one on Del Mar, right?
The one on Del Mar. Go to Stone, so take the goal line, get a couple of beers at Stone, and then we'll walk over a block away to Neon, and that's the way to do it.
That's the way to do it, because I used to go to the comic book store right there. So I go grab a beer and then go to the comic book store, or vice versa. I go to the comic book store and then go have a beer and read my stuff.
There you go. Hilarious.
So, yeah, I mean, like, you grew up in East LA, so I think we kind of started getting into that where you started exploring other food. Because like you said, you grew up with it at home. That's what you had. And like your dad supporting you in terms of like, go try something different. Let's go try something new. So you, would you say that's like where you kind of got started, where you're like, I want to go out there?
Nah, dude, it's a much more dark story, dude. It's like, I was one of those, you know, just typical depressed teenager kids. And, you know,
were you listening to Korn?
I was listening to Korn, Slipknot, you know, all that good stuff. I went to like Ozzy, I went to Ozfest and Crazy Town and Linkin Park, all that good stuff.
Crazy Town. I just recently made like I have Google Play, so I made a 90s K-Rock playlist. So I've been like listening to Linkin Park, Everclear, Deftones, all that stuff from back in the day.
Yeah. So my brother had like a good job. So he had like mental health, you know, like insurance. So I would go see like a therapist, and like, cause I was pretty depressed and all that stuff. And then it turns out that after those sessions, we would always go eat after.
Cool.
With my dad and my older brother, like, cause my older brother, he's lived in Venice for like, I don't know how long, 15 years or something, like a long time. So,
he's seen it change,
but that's a different podcast. We would go eat out, and I realized that like what was helping was just exploring all these other cuisines and tasting these flavors and just tripping out on all these other flavors. And that's what was therapeutic to me. Well, that's what I gravitated toward. So that's how I got started getting into it. So it just, that was the way. And then from that, you know, we still lived over here. And then I went to 2 years to Garfield High School, and then I transferred to Alhambra High School for the last 2 years.
And then
Alhambra High School is one of those places where like if you want to go try eat out, like a banh mi is like $3 or $4. You know, it's really affordable to if you're like a high school student.
So I love Lee's.
I love Ballet, dude. Ballet is a hood spot. That's an Atlantic. that's a good spot right there. But yeah, so just trying all these foods and I realized, you know, in the peak of my like, you know, punk rockness, I was like, man, like, what's more punk rock than being paid to eat, you know? Like, and then I would read Jonathan Gold on LA Weekly because I had a long bus ride back home to East LA.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, if this guy can do it, I can do it too. So I emailed him, just cold shoulder emailed him, like, hey, what's up? And he responded, and then, yeah, he took me under his
wing. This is back like in the early 2000s.
Yeah, this is back in like, I think 2005, 2004. And then and I started the blog in 2007.
Yeah. So, that's when you were calling yourself the teenage
listener. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, age appropriate.
Yeah, exactly. So... You know, and it was cool. I just, you know, like when you're blogging, you really have this intimate relationship with it. When you're like, oh, like you're just like, you're pouring yourself out there, especially if you're like a writer, you know, you kind of treat it like an extension of a journal or a diary. And then like you realize, you know, you start getting comments and you're like, oh shit, people are reading. So then that's how it started. And this was back then before Yelp, before...
This is before like everything that we know as social media.
Exactly. So there wasn't much out there. So luckily I started that early and that young. And yeah, man, so I got that head start. And then I started, and then just people started really to care. So I just kept it going and going. And then I got my first paid gig when I was a junior, when I was 17 or 16. And for like one of those like... magazines, like those like local magazines. It was called Latin, L-A-T-I-N.
Oh, I wrote something for them.
Yeah,
too.
You too. I did.
Latin. I wrote like this BuzzFeed like little like questionnaire for the artist as Shizu, I took it seriously. Like I wrote down questions.
Yeah.
You know,
and this is before BuzzFeed, right?
This is before all of that. And then I like, they asked me like the day before, like, this is what you should ask her, and they're like, what's your favorite color? Like, what kind of foods do you like to eat? Like, what's your favorite record? I'm like, all right, I guess.
So they published it and everything?
Yeah, they published it. Man. Like, it was a two, well, it ended up being a two-page spread because they incorporated more of her art instead of, like, the text, so.
Got it. So, yeah, man, that was it. And then after that, just, you know, I'm here right now. So it's been a crazy, crazy road, but it's been about, like, a dozen years now. Right,
yeah, it feels like it, right? Like, time just keeps moving forward, and you're like, I'm still at it. You still got to keep grinding.
Although now we're in the generation of like social influencers on Instagram, and that's crazy, you know, because they're doing like a blog post. I mean, they're doing an Instagram post, and that's kind of treated the same way as like a full story.
No, I mean,
you know?
Things have changed so dramatically. Yeah. I mean, for speaking for myself, I mean, that's how I've kind of been able to stay ahead of the curve. But sometimes it's because, you know. Like you, I jumped on it like a little head on before everybody caught on to it. And not necessarily started using it as like a social media platform the way you use it now. I mean, I did because I had MySpace and everything too.
Yeah.
But it was more for like, this is a tool. Like I was a
blogger, right?
Yeah, I was blogging because I was at ELAC at the time. I think
I remember. And you had like on your Twitter, it said like Los Angeles Titlan or what?
Los Angeles Titlan.
There you go. And I was looking like this guy,
which I got from Adolfo Guzman López. Who's a reporter on KPCC, but also a dope ass poet. He has a group from San Diego. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name, but it's a line that I heard from him when he was reading a poem, and that stuck with me. But I started using it as a tool, started making it into like what it is now, which is like making a living out of it, and like here we are, like a couple of years later. You know, I mean, the paths are different. But I think at the same time, it, a lot of the stuff that we were doing back then, it's kind of like, I trip out on it because it's still coming back full circle. Yeah. And I'm like, I remember when I did that or when that was going on or before that happened.
Yeah, you know, it is what it is. But we're here right now and still freelancing and still strong. So still trying to be stubborn with making a living off writing. So.
Because there's no way other. So you were talking about the punk life when you were growing up. So. For a lot of folks that don't know you, because of where you grew up in East LA, you were also going to like the backyard gigs, right?
Yeah, man. You know, I don't know if anyone who's listening knows of like the life that was in East LA, like in the late '90s and 2000. But it was it was heavily just cholo and pretty hood, pretty barrio, I should say, Yeah, something, I was one of those, kids who like, Slipknot and Korn and all that. So then, in East LA, Boyle Heights, that would translate into like hardcore punk, right?
Oh, hell yeah.
Because, especially in Boyle Heights, and I remember being in Hollenbeck and getting a flyer, but it was back then when people would still go off flyers for gigs.
Yep.
And I got one and I went to go check it out. I was in sixth grade. And I went to go check out, it was a show on Mott and like,
and these are like at people's houses. Like,
yeah, of course it was,
they got a big driveway. Yeah, they got a big yard.
Yeah, exactly. It was, the UCLA and Boyle Heights backyard punk scene has been alive and kicking, since like the late '70s. And different bands, different generations, different styles of punk,
but different iterations,
and it's still alive to this day. So yeah, so I got sucked into that whole circle, and fortunately, because otherwise, who knows what would have happened? You it's really easy to get caught up with the wrong kind of circles here. So it's and I got a little bit of that too, but luckily, because there's always like those couple of cholos who go to the pit in the punk show and like
and
beat up on punks, and knock you down, but they take it like, it's like for them, it's like some deep trauma that they're like,
it's like, I gotta like physically beat somebody else up to like feel better about myself.
Yeah, but I still have all my teeth. So shout out to that. Just that, that kept on, it snowballed into, there was a peak moment in the East LA, in the East LA and backyard punk scene, City Terrace punk scene, when there was like multiple gigs on weekends, that I got sucked into that. And sure enough, as you grow up, you realize that like, you don't really realize like how special, how unique the fact that you had access to this.
You're just in the moment.
Yeah.
Like, this is like nobody else. Like, this is what it is. It's just kind of that normalcy is like, that's like, you go to weekend on the gig, you go to the gig on the weekend with the homies, maybe somebody does something dumb, it turns into an adventure. Then you're like, go back to school on Monday. You talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, and I remember back then, like, there were shows that would get raided with like paintballs, or that would get raided with like tear gas, and like, even one.
And this is from the police.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and even at Self Up Graphics too, like for some of those scotch, the old school spot, and there were some of those ska wars, like some of those scotch shows there too. So, it's been there, and it's. So at one time, I don't know how it happened, but I think I met up with an editor, and like I brought up him a conversation, and he told me, oh, you should write about this. You should consider pitching it. So. Up until that point, I was just writing about food. But if you're a writer, you're a writer. You can write about anything. And so, like, okay, let me try. I guess people want to read about this East LA backyard punk scene. Sure enough, I pitched it. And also in like 2011, I published an article. It was called Anarchy in East LA, or I think that was like a pun name. The East LA backyard punk scene lives on, or something. One of those old school like golden era like LA Weekly kind of headlines. And people loved it. People around the world were like, the punk scene, very DIY, very supportive.
Oh, man.
And then you know, I get a phone call one day, and it was from this woman called Angela Boatwright, and she was like, "Oh, hey, Javier, I read the story. I want to go like document this. I'm a photographer." And you know, and I bring her to the scene, and then
I take her to the gig.
I vouch for her, and then
like she's with me. Put a stamp on her hand.
Exactly. And you know, she was, I don't know where she's from, but I think from, she had moved here from New York, and then it became like Los Punks or whatever the world we have.
The Vans documentary that most of y'all have probably seen like on Netflix or like just around town.
Yeah, you know, and it was at the moment, you know, it was really special because you know I. Yeah, I was very young, and I just thought it was cool because I'm more of the mindset like, you know, there's so many of these bands and so much talent and just these kids that just come in and out of the scene and like nothing gets recorded of them. I mean, there's no archiving, just no. But they make some pretty good music sometimes, you know. And so I thought like, oh, it would be cool to have this like in the spotlight. But I didn't know it was gonna blow up to those proportions.
I mean, that just kind of happened organically because I mean, you're from the scene. You see what it is. You value it. You understand that value, and you want to share it with other folks.
Yeah.
But it's in that translation from when you know, you want to connect other folks to it, and then what the other folks bring into it. That's where like the clash happens, and that's where like things to me always get lost in translation in one way or another.
I don't know. It's the way I see it. You know, like I know like natural corrupted youth. Like he got to go to China, man, and Las Cochinas, this other band, they got to go to like I think Korea
when they were doing the tour for
the documentary for like the Off the Wall campaign or whatever. So, you know, these kids from the hood got to go experience these kind of cultures, and I feel like I that's because of that story I wrote, and like you get exposed.
They got to get out of the neighborhood for a while.
But you know, the punk rock, the punk scene is very what's the word for it? Like cannibalistic sometimes, you know. It's like sometimes they just like talk shit. It's a very ironic and a very weird genre of music that like, oh, is it really punk if it's not? Well, it's punk rock. It's kind of, you know, it's easy to justify or rationalize things, but
yeah, no, you can't get nitpicky like that.
Exactly, it is what it is, and. You know, now, like, I don't know if you know this, but, like, Corrupted Youth, Nacho, they came out in that Will Smith movie on Netflix.
Oh, the Bright movie?
Yeah,
oh,
dude, that punk band that was playing there, that was them? That was them. And that's, guess why? You know, like...
Hey, that's sometimes all you need. It's just, like, somebody to put the light.
And I saw it when I was in Europe in a jet lag as hell, and I just, like, saw it, and I was like, hey, it's a pretty good movie. I enjoy it.
I for one, like that movie.
I loved it, dude.
I mean, I don't necessarily agree with the comparison that it was Lord of the Rings meets Training Day. I would say it's more accurately... Lord of the Rings meets Colors.
Yeah, you know, exactly. I agree with that. It was I loved every second of it, and I went in it with no kind of bar. I just saw it.
I know,
oh,
this
damn
movie's not gonna get an Oscar. It's entertaining. It's really good entertainment.
But also, you know, Will Smith just does a really good job of he knows the hood, or at least he's played it for a long time on TV and movies. So
yeah,
I appreciate seeing that.
Because when I was going into it, I was like, all right, kind of like think about it like this is Bad Boys 2.5.
This is Bad Boys X-Men.
This is because Bad Boys 3 ain't coming for another while, and yeah. I would go see Bad Boys 3 on opening day.
So you know, it's come that far, you know, like a band from East LA Boyle Heights that like literally just shouts into the mic just got on a Netflix show. I mean, a Netflix movie on a Netflix original with Will Smith. So it's like,
no, I mean, like that's putting it forward. And I mean, and on top of all of that too, is like all the friendships you've made, because you were part of a, you had a band for a little while too, right?
Yeah, man. That's how I started. Shout out to Oscar Vomit, Lalo, and Mike. We had a punk band called Bad Influence, and we released a little LP sampler, and that was some awesome times. And but yeah, man, you know, still to this day, you know, it's like, you know, it wasn't a phase, you know, it's like a way of life.
It's a way of life.
So, you know, and I still try to go to a show every once in a while too. And I do want to have a special moment of silence for, there was a punk who died tragically in an accident, last week.
Oh, damn.
She was on her way back from a TSL show, and, she had an accident, with a semi, and she did not survive. So, Jessica, rest in peace. I went to middle school with her in Hollenbeck, so we lost a really good one. And I think there's a benefit show for her on Sunday at the 5-Star Bar. If anyone is interested,
I mean, so, if there's a GoFundMe to help pay for like the cost or anything like that, please plug it, man.
Yeah. So, but yeah, the punk scene, man. You know, it's a really big part of living in East LA and Boyle Heights, you know, because it's this community of people that just accepts you for whoever you are. And it's really aggressive, and sometimes you just need to have an avenue like that, you know, for yourself, because you see a lot of fucked up shit here, you know.
Yeah, we all live through a lot of traumas, and you know, it's those teenage years where you're trying to make sense of it, because you know something's wrong, but you don't have the understanding, the mental you know, maturity or emotional maturity. Myself, I didn't have any emotional maturity till like I turned 30. Mm-hmm. So you try to figure out it one way or another, and then you find these kind of spaces where you can connect with folks that are almost going through the exact same thing, and then like that's so comforting and reassuring that, you know, shit's fucked up, but, you know, the homies got my back, and, you know, we'll make it through the next day and just try to figure it out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Damn. So, so did you, I think you got credits for like the Vans documentary, right?
For personal reasons, I have not actually seen it yet.
Oh, I can't imagine. Well, I liked it. It was dope. Like they like, it's pretty traditional storytelling. You know, they're highlighting the stories, they're focusing on specific folks and their journey and like what their investment is into like the scene. So that perspective of like, you know, somebody who's, you know, going houseless from like one space to another and is getting support from the community, to somebody who I completely forget their names because it's been a while since I saw it, where he's like one of the folks that's, him and his sister were the organizers and promoters for like a lot of shows and setting shows up in like people's houses and stuff like
that. That was Nacho. That's the same guy. Yeah. I mean, Nacho has kept the scene alive just because he's the only one who throws the shows nowadays. So every other weekend he still throws them. So
damn.
Yeah, it used to be his sister too. I don't know if she's still involved or not, but yeah, and that's the same guy who came out on Barai, and he's the only steadfast guy who just
keeps still holding it down. Because if nobody else does it, then like I tried to think what happens to the scene. But exactly. I mean, even if this, something does happen and it goes away for a couple of years, there's no doubt it'll come back.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just look at a band like Union 13.
You know,
they're the only band out of here that ever made it to like a major label. They got signed by Epitaph, and they released their album, and it's a masterpiece. East Coast Presents, and I think now they're coming up on their anniversary. So yeah, and that band, you know, the singer actually moved to, I think, Wisconsin, but he still comes back and plays like a couple times a year because he told me I don't want kids to forget. You know, I want to still stay relevant. Union 13. So like you said,
of course,
even if it's like dead for a little bit, there's always going to be punk shows here.
That energy's always going to be there.
One person or another, one kid or another is going to.
Man, I remember that because I was like a skater in high school, and I was like, "What's Union 13?" I was like, "Shit." Yeah, I've been sleeping on this.
Union 13, Boyle Heights in general has harbored this really unique sound that kind of just took a lot from like the New York hardcore sound. There were bands like Set Aside in Union 13, and Difference of Opinion, The Convicts, Ridicule. Boyle Heights in general has maintained this genre of like skate punk / hardcore.
Yeah.
You know, so that, and that's really cool because not many neighborhoods in LA have done that and have stayed so gender specific. Genre specific. Well, Boyle Heights is one of them. You know, there's always shows in the Valley and South LA, and in like deeper East LA. But Boyle Heights has kept this genre.
The punk rock, and I remember for a while too. Like if we wanted to catch a metal gig, you had to go out to South Central.
Yeah, or ska gig. South Central has always been the place for ska gigs, and that's another podcast. I love how ska gigs have always been. The majority, straight edge, and you know, and not much alcohol, and just in all ages, you know, that's
a really cool thing. Yeah. I took my girlfriend Marisol to a ska gig in Southgate not too long ago because my roommate wanted to go. It's like, because she's from New York, if people don't know that, but she's from New York. You know, the only time she's been to LA has been like a handful of times, you know, when we hooked up, and then a little couple other times before that. So she doesn't have like, you know, where's this, where's that kind of thing going. So with us, it's like I'm always taking her like, yeah, this is the spot for this, this is the spot for that. And yeah, like let's go to a ska show. You've never been to a ska show in LA. So you got to at least go check it out and see what it's about.
I still try to go every once in a while too. I just saw this. I always try to see Matamoska. I always like them. They always put on a good show. They're really happy. High energy. And then like, you know, it doesn't matter like, you know, how old they've been around. They still play the same damn good songs and just as fast, which is hard to do if you're like a fast music band because you start to slow down, you get tired of it. Exactly. So I always, yeah. And you know, and they're still just as those shows are just as intense as, you know, as they were like 10 years ago.
Yeah, man.
You
know? I love that. I think that's one thing I enjoyed the most is like seeing, I mean, I can say this now, all the quote unquote young kids, like, you know, just getting down and like having a good time. Cause I remember that used to be me.
Yeah.
But now I'm just like in the back, like, yeah, with my arms crossed, like with my beer.
Now you're an old punk.
Yeah. It's like in the back looking.
Like, there's this quote of this saying, it's like, old punks never die. They just stand in the back.
It's like, get back in there.
Yeah.
Just shove you back in. But okay, cool. So you said you graduated. I think you ended up graduating from Alhambra High, right?
Yeah, barely. Yeah. Barely. I taught my teacher how to play Angel Baby on the guitar, so he passed me on
bartering
pre-algebra he passed me, and I tried doing PCC for a while.
Passing in college, because I remember when you were going, and I was like, I can relate to you because you were going through that math struggle.
Oh yeah, dude. Oh yeah, man. Don't even get me started. Like, I failed. I think I did like my final count of, I think I failed algebra like in my total academic career, I think like 15 times.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I had to put in work. I had to sit down and
summer school.
Down.
You know, like all those other like whatever other some like little
winter session.
Yeah, exactly. And I just couldn't pass it. And then that's when in high school they made it possible where you can take accounting for math, for your math credit to graduate on stage.
Oh, no shit.
So that was a Alhambra. So I did that, and that's why I said I barely made it. And then but in college, you know, I came back and kicked me in.
It's the general ed, yeah.
And then I couldn't pass it. I ended up dropping out. shout out to dropping out.
No, I mean, because I went through the same struggle when I was at ELAC. When I registered and I started taking classes, you know, you take the placement test, they'll tell you where to start off. So, you know, I started in the English 60s, and I knocked out English in, like, 2-3 classes, no problem. But with the math, I had to start it all the way in, like, the beginning remedial math. Yeah,
same here.
And I just had to, like, grind away. Yeah. And I was like, all right. And I think the last one I needed was, like, calculus, because that's the one you're able to transfer with. So, I mean, I wasn't, like, a math whiz at it either.
Yeah.
But, like, I had to sit down, had to go get help at the tutoring center.
Yeah.
You know, and I was always, like, at least pass by with, like, a B or a C. So I was like, that's all right, nice. Isn't that... It's not impossible, but it just took a really long time. And like that kind of like energy of like you got to start from the bottom, especially for a math where like you had to take 5 or 6 classes to get up to the graduation level one. And then by that time, I felt like I'm done with this. Why am I going to pay even more money and like devote more time to be like this frustrated and like and it was just like, nope.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and that's at PCC. I mean, it became a problem in a bunch of colleges in general and community colleges at least. So that's when they created that class that I wrote about.
That's right.
I forgot what it was called. Like, I think it was called Statistics 50, which was kind of a 2-part stat kind of course that would really like teach you super slow and break it down. And that class became almost like – it was almost like a set of a stand deliver, dude. It was like all these like outcasts, you know. Like there was, I remember I'm never gonna forget this one guy from like North Pasadena in the hood who like – he owned his own like tow truck, like company. He was like a repo, like a tow truck repo guy.
Shit. Yeah.
And like he, you know, but he wanted to go back and, you know, just for whatever reason to go back and get his degree, but he couldn't pass it either. And it's just like, and the whole, you know, there was a bunch of moms and a bunch of just people.
So it's folks like, you know, trying to go back.
But they're living lives, their lives already, but they want to just get like a piece of paper just for, you know, for whatever reason
that
they want
accomplishment,
to.
Yeah.
And a lot of people still didn't pass. And you know, and then that's what prompted me to pitch that story to Sokolo that I wrote like in 2012 about you know, how I couldn't pass algebra class. And it struck a chord, man. People still to this day slate me for that.
Like, is that my math student trauma?
Yeah, people. And I think now, I don't know if like they're like the people that email me about it, but I think they put something on the ballot. So
it's, I think, not, it got changed.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't remember the details either. But like when you wrote it, there was like already some of that momentum going on in the back of like, this is an issue, because you know the schools and like with the governing boards and everything look at data of like, well, why is this a problem? Because like these kids aren't passing this specific math level or whatever. All right, well, we gotta figure something out because we can't have all these like kids dropping out.
So I wrote about it, man, and it's still, I think, like it got syndicated in like KCRW and like the Sacramento Bee or something, and it just made a splash. And yeah, but you know, I ended up dropping out eventually. I mean, for other reasons. The main reason was like I actually had my first accident on my Vespa, and I fell down and I broke my foot, and I didn't have insurance, and that was back before Obamacare, and it was a big mess. And that was actually on the second day of schools, you know, and the system back then, they would just drop you if you didn't show up. Yeah. So I just never enrolled because I was already like freelancing for like LA Weekly.
You're doing
like,
other stuff.
I was doing my thing already, you know, and at the same time, I wanted to go major in journalism, quote unquote, but I didn't realize that like they were teaching you like an antiquated system, you know, like
no, it's so, pretty bad.
It was changing so fast. So
you sometimes at these schools, I mean, they're bad, but at the same time, they're great. But only if you know folks who have been there and they can point you to the right professors or like the right way, you know, to take the workload. Because sometimes if you just go in there on your own and you go talk to the counselors at the school, you know, they're just gonna try to tell you, well, this is what it says on this sheet. Here you go.
Yeah.
Just do that.
Yeah. No, it's true, and it. Yeah, and that makes a world of difference. Is having whatever counselors, you know, or whatever special if you're involved enrolled in like ELP or what's the other one? There was another one, I think PASS or whatever, but
something.
Yeah, but they make a big difference. But you know, it's funny because actually I tried my best to like transfer, and I, of course I'm like, oh, where do I want to go? Well, like Annenberg journalism, right? Like
let's just casually go there.
Let's do it. Like, you know, it's no big deal. And I'm like, all right, I fill out the application. And then I was like, okay, that who should write my letter recommendation? Like, I'm a teacher, a past professor. Like I never really had the best record with any professor. So I was, who should I ask? And then I asked Jonathan Gold.
Yeah, I remember.
And he said, yeah, so you wrote it, which I should probably look. I don't even know if I still have it. I should like look it up and frame that shit, man, because that's pretty crazy. But yeah, he wrote it, and like I still got rejected.
Can't get a pass from Jonathan Gold.
So, but it was all because of my math. I mean, for sure, my math was like pretty horrible compared to everything else. So, but I mean, I it was almost like a blessing in disguise because now I'm like debt free. So,
no, dude. I mean, I that's kind of how I look at it. Because when I dropped out, I was like the same kind of reasoning. Like, I got all this other stuff going on for me. I should just focus on that, and I kind of like put school to the side for a while.
Yeah.
And even now, I mean, I kind of think about it, but I don't want to.
Like to go back?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm older. I have different.
But for what though? Like what? Like what? Like
just
what?
To finish. They kind of like, oh, just like some of the books you were okay. talking about. Like when yeah, we were like taking those classes. Yeah, it's like I did it. So what?
Yeah.
Got it. I mean, a lot of the like when you try to get like a job in anywhere, especially in nonprofit world, they're always like, "Where'd you go to school? And how many like degrees are under your got belt?" It. I was like, "None." I was at ELAC for 7 years. Is that like that's an honorary super doctorate? Senior. Yeah,
super senior doctorate from the East Los Angeles Community College.
It's the same title as Dr. Dre,
with a minor at Rio's Pizza.
Yeah, but you know it's not even there anymore.
I know, dude. I know.
But so you had a lot going on. I remember you also you started writing for the Alhambra Source, which is kind of well, I think the sister blog to the Bull Heights Beat and Bull Heights because it's. It was funded by USC, and they got journalists to come in here and, like, help community folks, you know, put out stories of the community.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of got where I got my chops, like, working in a everyday paper, you know, learning, like, you know, the who, what, where, why's, and how to write something, and how to edit stuff, and all that stuff. So that was really cool because, you know, that hyper-local is dying. Hyper-local journalism is dying, you know, with LA is dying, yep. with LA Weekly dying. And it's cool to see that they're still around, right? I mean,
they're
still around for sure. And but I got my kicks from there first. I got my chops from there. And yeah, that was they really helped out a lot. And Alhambra is one of those neighborhoods too because it's kind of the first neighborhood of the San Gabriel Valley. Mm-hmm. I mean, aside from Monterey Park, but like it's a really cool cultural kind of a melting pot because that insinuates that everything just homogenized. It's a salad bowl.
It's problematic.
It's a really cool salad bowl and really good Asian food, really good Vietnamese, regional Chinese, and all this really cool stuff. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have so many fun times out there eating, and when I think about it, sometimes like that's kind of almost all like what I do over there.
Me too. I still bust a mission to this day, you know, to go eat dim sum almost every single weekend, or go have pho almost like, you know, a couple times a month too.
Yeah, you got to switch it up. Or Sichuan like, food. You know, I love beating it, but I can't be doing that every day either.
Yeah. Although I'm telling you, when you just go to Europe for a month and eat bread all day, you're going to like, oh my God, this is so good. Marisco, tortillas.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's been my experience. Like the few times I've been able to go to New York or like other places. And, you know, you're just out of the hood for a good minute, and you're like, you appreciate what you have back here.
Dude, today, I swear to God, I almost cried. Dude, I was like, I was stuck in traffic, but like, I was like, because I had to go to like mid-city, like kind of by Lacma for like an errand, and it was just like so beautiful, just like seeing all like the restaurants along like Koreatown, and I swear to God, I saw like a fucking hawk or some shit fly over me on the 101. And
the red-tailed hawks are in the neighborhood.
Yeah, dude, and I was like, it was so, and like, you know, it's like, it doesn't even matter, like. Traffic is like, you know, you don't really care, you know, it doesn't faze you if you're from here, you know, it's just you just live with it, so
you just do it,
man. Yeah, so yeah, it's gonna be back home.
No, I feel you on that one. So you were doing like pieces at like LA Weekly, LA Times every once in a while, other news outlets, but at some point too I remember you also became I don't think they're doing them anymore, but like the Street Food Awards, you were like one of the folks that became a judge.
Oh yeah, too. Yeah. They asked me to be a judge on like the Vendies, which was this
the Vendies.
They're originally from New York, from the East Coast, and they tried doing it over here in LA. And I think
it was like 2-3 years they did it.
Yeah, yeah. But it's unruly out here. It's a wild, wild west when it comes to street vendors. So I think they underestimated the La Raza over here.
They did, because like somebody, I forgot her name.
Yeah, and we shouldn't forget her name. We should know her name.
I think it was Lupita's. No, Carmen.
Carmen.
Carmen. Antojitos Carmen. Antojitos Carmen. She won one of those years.
Yeah, and I think it was Carmen and then someone else too who won too, who would make the deep fried quesadillas that puffed up really tasty.
I don't remember.
And she had a salsa de semilla. But anyways, rest in peace, Breed Street. You're still in our hearts.
Yeah, so what was that experience like, judging the food? Because, I mean, you're always writing about it, and I think this is more fun. Like, you know, you're just eating, there's like a whole event.
Yeah, you know, all these activities, you know, like extracurricular activities, you know, like being on this podcast, like, you know, just like having people like pick your brain or trusting you to be a judge on a show. Those are like, you know, the really cool perks of like of being a journalist sometimes, and especially specializing in food like I did. And it's awesome, you know, but you know, I feel like I'm lucky that I grew up in the, you know, here, and I grew up in the Nevada, that like I always remember in the back of my mind, it's like, you know, it's like, this is some like first world fucking shit, you know, like, you know, like, you know, like writing about food, and, you know, yeah. Like, you know,
in the larger spectrum of things.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, and so I always try to remember, you know, especially when being a judge, it's like, you know, just enjoy it all. And it's like, you do realize that, like, you know, like people have spent like their, you know, like their, the, you know, their a small fortune of like their entire savings, mm-hmm. or it's like their livelihood. So it's like, yeah, do what you got to do. And it's all, but you know, don't take it too serious. Cause at the end of the day, it's just like, it's just fucking food, man. You just got to enjoy it.
You got
to
enjoy it.
And it has to be good. And if you can't enjoy it, and if you can't afford it, like what is it there for, you know? And Gustavo Arellano, he told me the best. Cause I remember the one time I was like, man, like I'm out of pitches. I don't know what else to write. Like, I'm so, you know, when you get not writer's block, but like just kind of like
kinda hitting a wall,
drained. You just got like, there's just sometimes you just get feel so drained. And he texted back and he's like, dude, like, what's it called? Like writer's block or that kind of, that's like a white construct. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, dude, our deal is like fucking build fucking houses. And we're just fucking around on the keyboard. Like, just chill the fuck out. I'm like, damn, you're fucking sore, right? I'm like, and I don't want to like undermine, you know, any kind of like of mental issues, you know, that you can have or like anxiety, you know, cause I have anxiety. Like,
we all have our little baggage.
So it's, but it's true, you know, and I feel like that, I feel like in the food writing world, that kind of writing about food and drink and its culture, and how it relates to, how it relates to the real world. Coming from that background, I feel like I'm lucky, and that I can write about these things, and always in the back of my head remember, like, you know, my homies from the hood, like, you know, I want them to be as entertained as like an affluent person who can go like afford and eat this too.
Yeah,
you know? Like, it has to have like a fine line, a fine balance of like hitting all these, like, you know, like it has to be appeal to people from a wide range of spectrum, which up until this point, like, food writing it's been pretty, like, you know, what's it called, like, just for the privileged few or very
no, I mean, it's one of those places where, you know, there's a lot of barriers to try to get in there.
Yeah, especially, you know, now, you know, with everything, it was just, you know, everything's expensive, and the cost of food, and it, you know, so when you go eat out, you know, it better be worth it, and it better be awesome, you know. So
like, I better get some doggy bag home.
yeah exactly, you know. So
but yeah. I think that that's also something that's changed in the last couple of years across the spectrum in almost any field you can think of. But with food writing and like food in general, it's just like that whole wave of social media where now, you know, like this, like you were talking about this earlier, like the social capital that folks have, and how media, especially social media, has kind of like, you know, leveled the playing field on how things work now with Yelp and folks having their Instagram followers or like maybe they're a person of interest. It's like, do you feel sometimes that pressure that like you got to keep stepping your game up? Because there's like 10,000 other people over here with like Instagram accounts or like Snapchats. And they're like, ooh, look, I like to eat food. Look at me. Look at my food.
Yeah, man. Instagram food and Yelp has definitely changed the way that we eat and process food forever, for sure. But you know what? I'm old school, man. I'm old school and I'm stubborn. You know, I still have ethics and I try my best to practice, you know, and just stay good to myself and stay true to myself, you know, because a lot of these Instagram accounts, you know, a lot of them are like, you know, they buy their followers, or a lot of them,
it's a lot of fluff.
It's a lot of fluff, man. Or it's a lot of like, you know, free food and free food's awesome, but sometimes just, you know, there's a big, and like, I feel like I'm lucky that I caught like the tail end of journalism, like the golden era of journalism, where I still, my morals and my
like, no, I feel you on that. Everything, like, you got that foundation.
Yeah. You know, whereas now with like, I just, it trips me out, you know, like, I mean, and shout out to all those people who all those Instagrammers and social influencers who have worked hard to it and make it and to have all their followers. And, but it just trips me out to have like the fact that, like, you know, you sit your ass down as a writer and you like type out like 1,000 words and you take your awesome photos and then you go update them, and it's like a, you know, how much work is that? Like,
it's a process.
It's a process. But then, like, you know, now like social influencers on Instagram are like getting the same kind of treatment for that too. Yeah. So it's like, you know, it is changing. Journalism is changing, and that's not my fault. That's not your fault. That's not anyone's fault. It's just how things are. Attention spans, and it is what it is. But, you know, but like I said earlier, as the food should always be good, and if that's what food, media, whatever it is, whether it's an Instagram post or whether it's a 1,000-word story, it should help you. It shouldn't make you like hungry. It shouldn't make you like, okay, I want to put on your bookmark on Yelp. All right, if I'm ever in this neighborhood, I want to go try it out.
Yeah, no, I mean, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. Can you get somebody to go from like reading or looking or thinking to actually taking action and going like, I need to go to this place, not today, maybe tomorrow or the weekend or Saturday or whatever.
Yeah,
and then that's kind of like, I was kind of leading into that too, where now that's also kind of like where you've seen this happen online too, where like you have like the online pleitos, where especially, I've been in a couple of these where you know, you have folks who are like, you know, not from the neighborhood or like typical like food bloggers or like outsiders coming into the neighborhood and talking about stuff that, you know, for us, it's been like, yeah, like that's always been the norm.
Yeah.
Or like, we don't talk about them because that's just a secret because we don't want the cops to come and like arrest street vendors. Yeah. And I think the last big one was the elotero vendor from Highland Park.
Yeah. You know, it's,
or was it Lincoln Heights?
There's a big one in Lincoln Heights too. No, but the one I wrote about was in Highland Park. But that story, and I didn't give out his exact location, but that one was more about just like the fact that how street food was evolving in LA too, and how he started to accept Square. That was, I think, like, yeah. I wrote that I think like at the beginning of last year, so almost 2 years ago, and yeah, you know, but even before then, you know, I went on record like a long time ago, and I wrote a story because like why food writers should not write about street food in Los Angeles, and you know, I. Trust me, I understand, and I know that it's good, but I mean, I just personally believe that the street vendors are there to serve their neighborhoods, and it's a really fine line with sensationalizing them in any way, you know, with the media and drawing more people to them.
The biggest example to that is, and you kind of name dropped them a little bit, like was the Breed Street scene here in Boyle Heights and the Bank of America on Breed and Cesar Chavez, where, you know, at the parking lot of the bank, you know, on Sunday and Saturday nights, it's empty. There's another like public parking lot back there. So folks would set up, and they've been doing this for a long time. Like when the Big Buy was still there, folks would set up in front of the Big Buy and sell tamales, gelatina, champurrado, whatever is going on. But eventually, like in the early 2000s, it built up to this mass where the whole parking lot and the sidewalk was full. And you can get anything. Pozole, quesadillas, crepes. I think there's churros. I mean, like,
Plátanos.
Everything you can think of.
Pozole even, I think, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, that became the spot in the neighborhood where, you're like, yo, let's go almost a la Breed. Mm-hmm. You know, on a Saturday and a Sunday, you can get whatever you want. It's not like you had, you know, to go out of the neighborhood or anything like that. But, you know, slowly but surely, it started getting too big for its own good. And part of that, to me, was, like, the food bloggers coming in and, like, you know, check out this super secret spot that I found. Because that's part of what, you know, drives them to, like, I got to find a spot to break it. And that way, you know, all the attention can come to me that says, like, so-and-so, quote-unquote, discovered this spot.
Yeah, it's a lot about ego, and, you know, and it really it's a lot about restraining that, you know, and just kind of looking on, thinking, you know, because as a journalist, as a writer, you know, it's never about yourself in any way. It's always about, you know, the people that you're writing about, you know, but obviously, you know, if you want to be the first to write or the first to review,
if you want to break it,
then sure enough. But, you know, and it's tough because, you know, food, that's kind of like the job of a food writer, to write about good food. But it's more of a systemic issue, you know, with you know, street vending in LA. And that's the real issue in general. You know, like, we should not have to censor ourselves to write about these. I'm doing that out of like just sheer Because I grew up here and I know, you know, and I see
you
these
come
people,
from that. You
I see
understand
these people,
it.
I see these people every day, and you see their shit getting confiscated, and you see how heartbreaking it is, and you kind of out of kindness and out of just like, you know, you're able to understand and have empathy. But but the deeper issue is just street vending in LA and how it's illegal, you know, and this current the current thing that they're talking about to legalize it is not a good one either.
No,
you know,
and we've kind of seen this model before, like in the early 2000s in MacArthur Park with Mama's Hot Tamales, they created this permit system where folks would have like these kind of old fashioned Wells Fargo looking wagons, and they, you know, they could sell their stuff like based on a permit system, but it didn't work out for a lot of different reasons. If you just like step. You know, take a second, like, think about what goes into, like, becoming a street vendor. Your number one thing is that, you know, people point out they're not paying taxes. Mm-hmm. They're costing, like, brick-and-mortar shops, you know, all this revenue because they're the ones that have to pay, like, insurance, taxes, fees, business permits, all this other stuff. But at the same time, you know, for a street vendor, you know, they could lose everything in one night and then they have to start over again. So, I mean, trying to make that into, like, a system where folks can get permits and have to go take classes to get like health certification or food handling certification becomes a barrier when everybody's like monolingual Spanish speaking, when, you know, folks are maybe the best readers or writers, sometimes maybe illiterate. So then you start like really like confronting all these barriers of what it takes, you know, to really create something that's justifiable to let everybody do what they can. But at the same time, you know, I guess at some level appease the city to say like, yeah, we have a system. Cause I mean, I've been to other cities like New York, Detroit, they have their things
halal
set
thing,
up. Yeah. You know? And like for LA to still be lagging it is just like a big ass, like black eye to the city.
Yeah. And in respect to everyone out there who's fighting the good fight, you know, the LA Food Policy Council, good and, you know, and Rudy at Learn and, you know, they're, and you know, there's a bunch of people who are advocating it, but it's, you know, it's just politics. And
it's politics at the end of the day. People got to go to city council. They got to go talk to the council members, you know, as soon as they show up, like the haters start showing up.
Yeah.
And then that's when like business people start showing up and it just turns into a whole pedo.
Yeah. There's definitely more support. In my experience, I've seen more supporters than people against it. And or like the arguments for it are stronger than the arguments against it.
Yeah.
But even before that, in the 2000s, I believe that street vending was legal under a permit system under Mayor Bradley in the 90s. And
so
there
was
something.
Because, I mean, like, there's issues of the space between, you know, you can't block the sidewalk, but then you can. And, like, you have to give, like, I think it's, like, 4 feet if you can't block it or something like that, which is always going to be an issue. But, like, I mean, that's what ended up happening with, like, the Breed Street show is, like, not the show, the Breed Street scene, is that it got too big. And the parking lot is right next to houses. So people have to live next to this noise. And they, you know, constantly keep calling the cops. It's like, yo, come shut this down. Yeah. They're out here like 2 a.m., 1 a.m. I got to go to work. Yeah. And then, you know, not all the street vendors are the most clean vendors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, have a bunch of grease stains out on the sidewalk. So eventually, like, the city and the cops have to come and crack down on folks.
Yeah, it's a complicated, complex issue, you know, with many things to contemplate and resolve. But I mean, it's all the work is worth it. Because of how amazing street food is and how much it helps. You know, a lot of immigrants or people like my parents, like your parents, who don't have anything else or got laid off and they're older and they can't get a job. And if they're gonna take to making elote or making like a plátano frito instead of like some other shady shit, like fuck, let them. You know,
estilo Sinaloa, you know, Culiacan, like whatever, like, you know, from their hometown.
Yeah.
There's gonna be a market for that style.
So if you're gonna post about it, anyone out there on Instagram, post about it. And if anyone asks where it's at, just slide into the DMs and tell them.
I mean, that's usually how it traditionally worked before social media. Yo, I found this dope spot. Let me take you to the dope spot. Yeah. And the word of mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, because, I mean, at the same time, I don't want to blow up the spot and put their entire livelihood in jeopardy. But then I don't want to keep it a secret to the point where, you know, they can't make a living either. Mm-hmm. So it's a fine balance.
Exactly. But, you know, I'm an optimistic guy when it comes to that. And I think one day you and I will walk the streets of East LA and we'll be able to legally buy an elote. Not too tieso, not too tierno.
No. Blanco. And have you seen like the evolution now where like they're putting like crumpled up Takis and hot Cheetos on them?
Oh yeah, man. Yeah, the flaming hot Cheetos. Yeah.
I was like, why didn't everybody think of this sooner?
I'm a purist, you know. I like parquet, cotija, And simple. And other than is some.
Yeah, no, I mean, sometimes I'm like, yo, I can't be doing all of that, so just give me like chile and limon.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's, you're sophisticated, vato, now. You're like, you're gourmet now. You grew up.
Like, nah, I get that. I'm older, you know, I can't handle the mayonnaise and the cheese anymore.
Yeah, yeah. That's funny. That's true, though. You grew up and you have just limon and chile. And it's still bomb.
It's still fucking delicious. Like, yo, I'm on my way home. Just got off the bus and we get in a lot there. Boom.
Especially if it's a asado from El Mercado.
Oh, man.
You know, the fired roasted one.
I love that. And then one thing I also wanted to talk about, too. I mean, in between, you know, I want to say, like, your high point when you were, like, doing all this writing, you were judging food contests and everything. You also ended up on the Food Network with Andrew Zimmerman. Like, he came over to your house, no?
Yeah, man, that was crazy. That was a Travel Channel. That was that Travel Channel. That was when I first started the blog. I was literally, like, I think I was 17 or...
It was way earlier.
Yeah, it was way earlier, and it was in the first season of Bizarre Foods or something, I couldn't afford cable, so I didn't know what the hell it was, but I just got, like, an email from, like, one of the producers, and, you know, I was very young and very naive.
Let folks know what the show's about a little bit.
Exactly, and they asked me, oh, like, you know, Andrew Zimmer and Bizarre Foods is gonna come, and, like, do you have any ideas to suggest them? And, you know, this is before, like, before growing up, and before, like, oh, I let them pick...
I remember, you had long hair.
I let them pick my brain for free. No, I sent this really long, passionate email about, like, I wonder, like, to the rest of the world, like, people who eat nopales and, like, huilacoche would probably be a little... That's considered bizarre, like, if you think about it. You know, like,
corn for people.
Yeah, yeah. So I sent an email, and, like, they liked it. And then, sure enough, they came with their big old camera crew. And yeah, my mom made menudo and, like, made some gorditas de nopal y de huilacoche with masa azul from El Mercadito.
Yeah,
and, and yeah, man, and I didn't realize, like, how that moment really changed my life, because, you know, it just exposed me to, like, a lot of other people around the world, and I got, like, a bunch of emails, and, like, you know, especially for Mexican culture, you know, like,
yeah.
Back then, this was, like, 10 years ago, so that kind of stuff did not get much, just kind of an American television, like, you know, coverage. So.
And it still doesn't. Sometimes it's just like,
that was awesome. Yeah, and he's still Andrew Zimmerman is a really nice guy. You know, he really respects food, and he comes in it from a very... very like a like respectful, curious angle, not so much like someone who thinks they know it all, you know. Like, so he was definitely the right guy for it. So
nice. Yeah. This is hilarious.
Yeah, you know. And he also comes, I think he used to have like substance abuse issues growing up, so he definitely has like a right attitude to be able to talk about these issues and be aware of all these single components that make it happen. So.
Yeah, man. So more than anything, like, we're like an hour and some change into it now. I pretty much hit all the high points I wanted to talk to, like, about your career, where it's been, how you got started, you know, kind of where it's going now. So more than anything, like, you kind of dropped this already. You're working on a cookbook with the folks from Galagueta. If folks want to keep up with you, let them know, like, where can I keep up?
Yeah, I'm kind of all over the place right now. I'm freelancing for LA Times. I'm going to be doing some stuff for LA Taco coming up next week.
Yeah. Shout out to new editor Daniel Hernandez.
Oh, yeah, Daniel. You're my fucking hero, dude. I love you.
Low-key, though, I've been wanting, like, my own Vice show.
Yeah,
like the one he did where, like, he's doing Munchies and, like, they go eat food and shit. Oh, like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah. His stuff on Munchies is, like, legendary, dude.
He still, like, says on Twitter that he gets recognized as, you're the guy from Oaxaca.
Yeah,
on Vice, exactly. Mexican Munchies.
You're the guy who did shrooms there. Yeah. But yeah, so just follow me on the on Twitter and Instagram, I think, and just add me on Facebook, Javier Cabral, and then on Instagram and Twitter, just the Glutster. So at @theglut. STER. And if you're wondering what, like, how I came up with that, I was very dumb, and, like, I think I was like 16, and I was like, what could be a cool name for me? And I was like, I think, like, this is before, like, the word hipster had any kind of, like, demonic any kind of, like, bad kind of, like, that as bad as it is now.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, gluttony and hipster, so the Glutster. And sure, so, and that's how I got the name. So yeah, just follow me on.
Hey, man,
on
the Glutster. I still got my, like, high school email. It's like, dumb.
Yeah, like, whatever, at, like, hotmail.com or
MSN? Well, it's like Gmail, because originally it was Yahoo, but then, like, I switched over to Gmail.
mine was specs727@hotmail.com.
No, so. mine was Anime Manzi.
Anime Manzi, nice. Which, by the way, I need to start watching Dragon Ball, the new Dragon Ball Superman. I'm such a poser.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, I don't know. It's because I'm older and, like, you know, again, things come in circles. But right now, two things that are, like, you know, giving me life on the weekends and of course, on Monday and Tuesdays is watching wrestling and, like, watching anime. Like, everything's kind of, like, coming up on the end again. And, like, Dragon Ball Super has been off the chains. Like, right now, like, I'm on Saturdays, it airs in Japan, so I watch it on Mondays or Sundays, you know, because, like, that's how long it takes people to post up the bootleg version. But it's fucking sick right now, man.
Yeah, check it out.
And I'll give you the website where I watch, like, a bunch of bootleg TV shows and stuff like that, because, you know, I'm not trying to pay for cable either.
Yeah, I know. Cool, man. Well, thanks for having me,
awesome.
Dude.
Awesome. So thank you so much, Javier. I know this was super last minute because the folks that I had scheduled couldn't make it. So
yesterday, you're like, hey, what's up? You want to come through? And I was all fucking jet lagged and shit. And I was like, let me see. Sure, let's do it.
Yeah, yeah. So let's make it happen. Thank you so much, dude. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Of course, you know, follow online.
If you're still there.
If you're still there. But if you're listening through the SoundCloud, thank you. I appreciate that because now I ran out of, like, free SoundCloud space, and I have to start paying for it. In a couple of months, I'll probably have to, like, you know, upgrade my tier, because right now, they just doubled my time, and it's, like, $7 a month. And eventually, like, I'll have to go up to, like, the $15 a month, where it's, like, unlimited everything.
So it's a good investment, don't trip.
Yeah, yeah, I'm now a total tax write-off when it comes to, like, 2018 tax return.
It's so hard for us to, like, look in the future, and, like, with money spending, like, investing, and, like... I don't know, man.
Those Pokemon cards didn't hold out. But no, you know, I'm a lot better with my income now. I mean, I still go to the comic book store and, like, put down at least, like, $30-$40, like, every week. So.
Nice.
But that's you know, where I'm at now.
Baller.
Where I have that, you know, vendido money, apparently, because somebody said that.
Fuck the haters.
Yeah, you know. So, thanks again, Javier. Peace out, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, laters.